from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. What will happen now to the more than 2,000 children forcibly separated from their families under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy? That's among the many looming questions one day after President Trump signed an executive order ending his policy.
We now know that there are babies who have been left behind, parents who've been deported with their children left behind someplace in America. What kind of country does that?
That was Bay Area Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren outside the U.S. Capitol yesterday, and she'll join us later in the hour. At his own rally yesterday, President Trump pledged to keep families together, but again blamed Democrats. We'll find out what's next for those families and U.S. immigration policy after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump signed an executive order yesterday that he said would end his administration's policy of separating of migrant families at the U.S.-Mexico border. But big questions remain about how children will be reunited with their families, where detained families will be housed, and how the president will maintain his zero-tolerance policy when children under current rules have to be released within 20 days. We'll discuss what the order means for families currently in detention and those who will arrive at the border in the future. And we'll get an update on the immigration bills under consideration by Congress today. Joining us now is Ted Hessen. He's an immigration reporter for Politico. And welcome, Ted Hessen. Good to have you aboard.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And we're also going to welcome Bill Ong-Hing, who's professor of law and migration studies at University of San Francisco, author of several books on immigration policy and race relations, and has a forthcoming book called American Presidents and Immigration Policy. Good to have you back with us, Bill Ong-Hing.
Thank you.
Well, let me begin, if I may, with you, Ted Hessen, and let's begin by just focusing on the executive order. It would seem at this point that instead of separating families, we're putting them into detention together.
That's right. The president's answer to family separation, which he said publicly had bothered him and he was uncomfortable with, was to issue an executive order yesterday that would potentially allow the federal government to detain children along with their parents through the process. And this certainly wasn't the answer that many immigrant rights advocates were looking for and that Democrats were looking for. In their case, they would rather have these families released and given a date to appear in immigration court.
And what about these over 2,000 kids in terms of reuniting them with their parents? Do we know how this is going to be done? Is there any plan, any map?
That's one of the biggest outstanding questions, right? I mean, over about a five-week period in May and June, we had more than 2,300 kids separated from their parents. It's not clear where those kids are at the moment or around the country. It's not clear if their parents have been deported or not, or whether they still remain in detention. So it's also unclear whether the Trump administration even intends to try and reunite those kids. Yesterday, actually, a spokesperson from the Health and Human Services Department issued a statement that said there were no new procedures for the unaccompanied minor program, which really gave the impression that they weren't going to pursue reunification of these cases. And then about a few hours later, HHS actually issued a second statement walking back the earlier one, but still with no clarity as to whether there would be an effort to reunite these families.
Doesn't seem to be any system for that, and there doesn't seem to be much in the way of records as to where these kids are. It's fact possible. President Obama's ICE director said some of these kids may never see their parents again. Some don't even know what country they're from.
I mean, I think there will be really steep challenges, and people I spoke with last night who have experience with this said as much. But, I mean, there's going to be pressure on the administration. I mean, they put this policy forward, this zero-tolerance border arrest policy. They move forward with it for upwards of 2 months. And, now they're walking it back and trying something different. And I think there will be pressure for them to answer to some 2,300 kids who are out there without their parents.
We're talking with Ted Hessen, who's an immigration reporter for Politico, and I also wanted to get your take, Ted, on these two bills that are going forward. One is called more moderate, one is called more conservative. Those are just labels, but indeed they seem to fit the bill. But neither one of them seems to have the votes at this point to really do immigration reform through legislation.
So while this executive order was coming out and everything that's going on at the border right now, there have been two bills in the House of Representatives that Republicans have been pushing forward in recent weeks. And they're both somewhat similar, to tell you the truth. I mean, they both fulfill President Trump's different buckets on things he'd like to do with the immigration system, and they deal with family separations in the same way that he is, by allowing prolonged detentions of children along with their parents. But it does look like neither of them has a very good chance of passing. Even, you know, fulfilling the president's different immigration criteria, many conservatives still aren't comfortable with voting for something that may be called amnesty later.
Is the zero-tolerance policy still in effect? Do we know?
Yeah, that hasn't changed, and the administration has said as much. They're still planning on prosecuting anyone who's suspected of crossing the border illegally, and that goes for families, that goes for asylum seekers as well. They're, you know, the new part of this executive order is that they're saying that when they detain parents going forward, that they'll make efforts to detain children with them. Now, there is a caveat that that's dependent on resources, and it's dependent on the legal situation as well.
Can the executive order be challenged in court? Will it be challenged in court, in your judgment?
It almost certainly will. And the reason is, and the administration has acknowledged this, it essentially runs afoul of a settlement agreement that dictates guidelines for housing children in detention. And under that agreement, you can only keep kids in a detention setting for 20 days, and they should be removed at the first available opportunity to the least restrictive setting that they can be in. So with that in mind, it seems like it won't take long for there to be a legal challenge or some kind of issue with this. And because of that, the Trump administration is saying they want to go back to court and renegotiate that settlement agreement to allow for indefinite detentions of these kids.
And let me ask you one other thing before I bring Bill Ong-Hing into this. What about ICE getting funded to build more detention centers? And what about more judges, which money from Congress to have more judges, which President Trump has pretty much said is not necessary?
The Trump administration is asking for a big surge in detention beds in the next spending bill that comes up. And I think they're asking for 52,000 beds or so, which is up from 40,000 right now. So quite a big jump. Now, that being said, they've asked for this a few times now, and they've gotten some incremental raise. But it's not clear that they will get that detention funding. It's unclear to me also, under this executive order yesterday, the Department of Defense is authorized to help provide housing for families. And it's not totally clear to me exactly how this will be carved out budget-wise, whether it's something that ICE, Immigration Service, would have to pay for, or if the Department of Defense would pay for it. It's also not clear if either of them has the wiggle room in their budget to take on something like this.
Again, Ted Hessen is with us. He's an immigration reporter for Politico. And let me bring Bill Ong-Hing into this. He's professor of law and migration studies at the University of San Francisco. Just first, let's sort out what has happened here with you, Professor Hing. There was statements by President Trump that he did not have the authority to change this sense of separation between children and their families, but there were others who said it all it would take would be a stroke of the pen, and to a great extent, that seems to have been the case. How can we separate this from that is what the president thought were his powers, as opposed to what his powers apparently really are?
Well, of course, he had the authority to not separate the children from their parents. And in fact, under the Obama administration, there were some prosecutions, of course, of people that were entering without inspection, but never in those situations did they take kids away from those individuals. To the extent that that was happening, and not to the zero tolerance degree that is happening under the Trump administration, those families were kept together. And oftentimes they were kept together in places like Texas, first in New Mexico, and other times they were given these alternatives to detention, like ankle monitors or regular check-ins, that type of thing. Never family separation. The only time there was children taken away from adults was usually where there was some suspicion that the adults actually were not the parents and that they might be traffickers. But here we're talking about people that are acknowledged to be the parents of the children.
Could you outline for us also the 20-day rule? This goes back to the Flores,
yeah.
The Flores decree of, what, 1997? Yeah,
right, exactly. And so 20 days, it's it's kind of interesting to me that 20 days has become the normalized quantity of time. That's in fact not the normalized amount of time. The judge has made it clear, and Mr. Hessen alluded to this, that these children are supposed to be released from custody as soon as possible. Quite frankly, most advocates on the ground advocate that these children ought to be released immediately within a few days type of thing. And 20 days was the outer limit. And Judge G in the Central District of Federal Courts in Los Angeles has made that very clear. And so 20 days is the outer limit. I've been part of the federal inspection team that the federal court has authorized to go visit these detention centers to look at the conditions under which the children are kept. And in fact, I'm scheduled to go back to South Texas the weekend of July 7th, 8th, and 9th, where the judge is authorizing us to go in to look at these new facilities that have opened.
So I don't want to make this too utterly simple, but wouldn't the executive order be a violation of the Flores Agreement? Because the children could be detained indefinitely under this with no opportunity to present evidence that they aren't a flight risk.
It absolutely would be a violation of the agreement. And that's why the executive order says that the attorney general is going to go in to the federal court to ask that this be revisited. And they may be in there today. The attorney general may be in today or tomorrow to make these motions. And what's anticipated is the federal government's going to argue that it's an emergency situation, that there may be national security involved. These are the types of arguments that the Trump administration has been advancing for the last year and a half. And I don't think Judge G is going to have anything to do with that, because the situation of migrants coming to the border from Central America in large numbers has actually been with us since 2014 in terms of large numbers. And the numbers haven't subsided, so things haven't changed. What has changed is this zero tolerance policy of prosecuting anyone who's entered without inspection for the misdemeanor of entering.
We're talking again with Bill Ong-Hing, professor of law and migration studies at the University of San Francisco. Doesn't the executive order also, presently the way it's set up, eliminate basic protections for asylum seekers?
Well, see, this has to be viewed in tandem with a couple of other things that the administration has done just the last couple of weeks. So I'm losing track of time, but I think it was a week ago that Attorney General Sessions issued a precedent decision with respect to asylum seekers who are seeking asylum based primarily on domestic violence or gang violence. Any violence that he labeled as being done not at the hands of the government, that country's hands, but at the hands of a private actor, he's saying that's not what the purpose of asylum is, and therefore they can no longer apply for asylum. They won't be eligible for asylum. See, so that's what makes this more complicated, what just happened this week and the order yesterday, because the argument that the government is now positioned to make is that those women and children that are saying they're afraid of the gangs, they're afraid of the cartels, they're afraid of their spouses, in some cases of the women, that's why I'm afraid. The government can now say, well, that's not a basis for asylum, and so therefore we're not going to give you an asylum hearing because you don't pass something called a credible fear interview. That is potentially what the federal government may be arguing now. And you couple that with the fact that if you don't pass a credible fear for asylum, therefore you don't get to apply for asylum, you are then subject to something called expedited removal, which means that if you're not eligible to apply for asylum, they can expedite, they can remove you, they can deport you without a hearing before an immigration judge. And I believe that that's what the federal government is jockeying itself into the position to argue.
Again, Bill Ong Hing, professor of law and migration studies at the University of San Francisco. And let me go back to Ted Hessen, who is an immigration reporter with Politico. And there's been a lot of reports, Ted, and you can add to these, about some pretty disturbing stories about the trauma with these children, particularly some of them being allegedly put on psychotropic drugs, diseases and allergies and real trauma. Corey Landowski gave an interview yesterday, and somebody actually said to him, an interviewer spoke about a child with Down syndrome being ripped from her mother's arms, and he went, wow, wow. I mean, you know, it's gotten into real territory here that's terribly disturbing, profoundly so. What about human rights for children? Aren't they guaranteed human rights coming here under whatever circumstances?
Well, I think legally, as Bill was pointing out, I mean, what they are guaranteed is mainly falls under this Flores Settlement Agreement, which essentially serves to regulate the unaccompanied minor program here in the U.S. And the interesting part of what the Trump administration is trying to do, I mean, aside from the executive order and actions they've taken, they would like to see legislation that either modifies Flores or rolls it back. And I think, you know, in that kind of circumstance, you could see kids essentially treated as adults as they come into the country or quickly removed back to their home countries in Central America or elsewhere. You know, and I think those are all questions. And I think what's interesting to note is that advocates and activists have already raised concerns about existing family detention centers in the U.S. And those are structures that were, you know, built over a time, planned out. I mean, now we're talking about potentially erecting temporary shelters around the country hastily. And it really is a question of whether they will even meet the criteria of this Flores Agreement, much less broader sort of human rights criteria.
Well, we've been informed that Melania Trump is at the southern border today. She's meeting migrant children, and senators have not been allowed to do that by the administration. Want to comment on that, Ted Hessen?
Sure. I mean, you know, a few weeks ago we had Senator Merkley from Oregon actually going down to the border and trying to get into a detention center in South Texas and not being able to do so. And some reports of other Democratic lawmakers as well having that problem. Now, I will say since then there have been tours of certain Border Patrol holding stations and shelters and whatnot. And my understanding is some of these facilities are willing to open their doors up to lawmakers with some time. I think the initial reaction, you know, I'm not sure what fueled it, but it certainly seemed like there was a desire to keep criticism or Democratic lawmakers out who might criticize how the kids were being treated in the facilities.
Let me get back to the immigration bills with you, Ted Hessen. You have people going up to Capitol Hill like Kirstjen Nielsen and also Congressman Ryan, Speaker of the House, Jeff Sessions, pushing for this bill. At first, President Trump said, no, I don't support either one of them, and then he pretty much did a pivot on that and said, OK, I'll support this compromise bill, but doesn't seem to be pushing it to any great degree. And the reality is that you've got some real split between the Republicans. You got the Freedom Caucus on the one hand. I just want to get the lay of the land for this for listeners, objecting very strongly to what's in the bill that Paul Ryan is pushing for.
That's right. I mean, the president's role here has been kind of interesting. He seems kind of lukewarm on both these measures, even though, as I mentioned, they're accomplishing quite a bit of what he'd like in his immigration agenda. And perhaps that could be that he senses they don't have the votes to pass in the House, and he doesn't want to be backing a loser, you know, if it turns up they can't pass. I think another interesting thing to note is that he was actually on Twitter this morning tweeting that sort of what's the purpose of passing a bill in the House if it's going to head over to the Senate and it won't go anywhere because Democrats won't vote for it. And I think that there's actually a you know, some truth to that, because whatever the House does pass, each of these is fairly hard line and aligned with Trump.
We're talking about the necessity, of 60 votes in the Senate, and that's unrealistic from any perspective at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, and I should have made that clear. You know, to pass any bill in the Senate, they'll need, you know, a faction of Democratic votes to get it through. And particularly on immigration, it's unlikely that they're going to get that at this point in time. I mean, even over the past year, it's been difficult for Republicans to get any kind of cooperation from Democrats, but especially in the lead up to midterm elections in November and on this issue of immigration, which is so inflammatory and so contentious between both parties.
I should also say that the Washington Post is reporting that the Trump administration has stopped prosecuting migrants crossing the border with children. We'll bring you more information as we get it. But if that's true, Bill Ong Hing, response from you?
Well, that's true. That's welcome news. But what we then have is family detention. I still think that they're going to be detaining these migrants. The big facilities are in Texas, Dilley, Texas, and Karnes, Texas. And that's what we're afraid of, is that what we exchange for separation was family detention.
Bill, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you here because Jeff Denham is on the line, and he's probably going to be voting any minute now. And we wanted to hear from him, a U.S. congressman who represents Stanislaus and San Joaquin counties and helped author the Border Security and Immigration Reform Act of 2018. Congressman, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're coming up on a break here. I'd like to just get your thoughts very quickly. I was talking about the fractionalization going on in your party between the Freedom Caucus and those in support of what's been called the moderate bill and so forth. Are there real chances of either of these bills, particularly the more moderate bill, passing?
Well, first of all, I would not characterize it as a moderate bill. It is a very conservative bill, and it's partially that way because the Freedom Caucus put so many amendments in this. If they no longer support a bill that they amended, if they no longer support the measures that they put into the bill, they alone will be the cause of this not passing today.
Well, you know, you still have a Republican majority or a majority of members of your party who have backed the president from the beginning, including, you know, the what has been called inhumane dividing of families and so forth. I'd like to get your comment on that.
Look, I'm focused on making sure that we solve several different problems in our broken immigration system. That not only includes securing our border and building a permanent fence as well as technology to secure our border, but also addressing some of these loopholes, including asylum and visa systems, and finding a permanent fix for Dreamers. We do all of that in this bill today, but we also take it a step further to make sure that families stay together, that kids are never separated from their parents, and fixing some of the things that were even in the same challenges that we had under the Obama administration, making sure that children we're focused on safety for these kids.
Do you have the votes, though, to put the legislation through? And actually, you added that family separation to the bill,
yes.
I believe, didn't you? So
yes.
give you props for that, but are you going to get the votes for that?
It depends on the Freedom Caucus. You know, they negotiated this bill in good faith. If they no longer support the bill, it will go down today.
Can you stay with us through a break because we're coming up on one, Congressman?
I actually have to head over to votes. I'm happy to call back in, though.
Okay, if you can, we would like to hear from you because Zoe Lofgren on the Democratic side is going to be joining us after the break, and we're going to have to say goodbye to Ted Hessen, immigration reporter of Politico. And Ted, appreciate very much your input here. Thank you. And thank you to the congressman. I hope he can join us back. As I say, we'll be talking also with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. And let me invite you to join the program. There are a number of ways you can do that, as you know. The real topic here is what's next for immigration, families in detention, and so forth. Things are changing and are mercurial as we're speaking here. But you may want to weigh in, and if you do, let me tell you how you can. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. And again, we'll continue with Professor Bill Ong Hing. And you, our listeners, toll-free, join us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. Please feel free to be part of the program. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We're discussing next steps on immigration. Bill Ong Hing with us, professor of law and migration studies at the University of San Francisco, author of a number of books, including the forthcoming American Presidents and Immigration Policy. We had Ted Hessen on from Politico and Jeff Denham, Republican congressman. We're going to also be joined by Democratic Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, but we do want to be joined by you if you have questions or comments. And I want to get into some legal questions with Bill Ong Hing. There was an article, Professor Ong Hing, in the National Review by Rick Lowry, who is, I guess, the editor, in fact, of the National Review. And let me get your response to what he put forward. He said that holding asylum seekers has some advantages. If an asylum seeker is detained, it means that claim gets processed more quickly, months rather than years. And also, if adults are released while a claim is pending, the person can disappear, and that allows the migrant to live in the United States no matter what the merits of the case.
Well, here's the problem. Most of these individuals are being who are in custody represent themselves, and it's very, very difficult to get volunteer attorneys out to these rural areas where the detention centers are to help these folks out. And so to navigate the asylum system on your own is virtually impossible. Secondly, in terms of his second point, that people don't show up, in fact, under the monitoring system that's in place for folks, the statistic is somewhere around 98 to 99% appearance rate. So it's a fallacy to say that folks abscond. There are so many ways of monitoring folks, especially those with children, that it's a fallacy to say that there's an absconsion, a high absconsion rate.
Well, what about another argument we hear from Rich Lowry, and this probably holds true for a lot of those on the conservative side. He says that migrant flow to the United States is discretionary, and writes that the flow actually stopped early on in the Trump presidency. He says increased flow is more economic migrants who would prefer to live in the United States and not victims of persecution in their home country.
Well, the migrant flow from Mexico definitely has gone down. That started happening before the election. Under the Obama administration, the undocumented migrant flow from Mexico definitely was declining. It reached an all-time low. But that's not true with respect to Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Those are the main countries that we're talking about right now. The levels of violence in those countries have remained high. Every year, El Salvador and Guatemala are battling over, I hate to use that phrase, but they're battling over the recognition as the most violent country in the world. And so the people are not coming here for adventure or just to earn a living. This is not Mexico 20, 25 years ago. This is a violent situation that people are fleeing.
And once again, the Trump administration, according to the Washington Post, this was just released, is going to stop prosecuting migrant parents who cross the border illegally with children. That's according to officials. This is quite a dramatic about face. And you may want to comment on this or comment on what we're talking about generally, which is immigration policy and immigration families now being held in detention rather than separated. We do invite your calls. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Let me bring some callers in. Let me begin, Mariana, with you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Michael. I teach human rights education and human rights law in general at San Francisco State University. And as many other Americans, I'm really outraged at what's going on with the detention of kids. I was really glad to hear Congresswoman Barbara Lee has asked the UN to form a committee to come investigate the detention centers that hold children taken away from immigrants and also adult immigrants, too. Many of these centers, as we know, are owned by private corporations who profit from that. So I have two comments. One is that according to the 18th Amendment of the United States Constitution, this kind of holding children hostage and snatching them from their parents constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. So that's one of the comments I have and would like to hear from your guests what they think about that. The other is that the United States is the only country in the world that has not ratified, it signed but did not ratify, which requires at least two-thirds of the Senate to ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child. This is a convention that protects the rights of all children around the world, so that the United States isn't even considering ratifying it is completely and totally immoral. So those are my two comments, and I would like to perhaps hear from your guests what they think about, especially the Convention on the Rights of the Child that I haven't heard anybody talk about.
Well, I thank you for bringing up those two points, Mariana, and let me go to Professor Hing on them.
Yeah, the Convention on the Rights of Children, she's absolutely right. It actually has been debated in the United States, but it hasn't gotten anywhere. And it's critical. In Great Britain, the UK actually stopped detaining children because they are a signatory to that convention. There was some detention over a period of time, but because the advocates invoked that convention, the UK decided to stop detaining children. On her first point on the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, the precursor to the Flores settlement that we're talking about is a case called Reno v. Flores that the Supreme Court decided more than 20 years ago. In that case, the argument on behalf of the children was that the United States, back then, Immigration Service, should not have the authority to detain children. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court said, yes, immigration does have the authority to detain children. The conditions, however, we will leave to the lower court. And that's what led to the Flores settlement. When it was remanded to the lower courts, the agreement was reached between the government and the litigators. And the main part of the Flores agreement is that these facilities that hold children are supposed to be licensed facilities that are licensed to provide everything that's needed, from health and education and teaching to children. And that's what's constantly being monitored now by the federal court.
I've got Congresswoman Loftgren on the line. Before I do, though, what about the argument that putting these children into separate facilities and not having them see their parents is a form of torture, particularly given some of the conditions that have been reported?
My gosh, absolutely. That's the nature of the lawsuits that have been filed on their behalf, is that there's a clear violation of their constitutional and international human rights.
Well, let me bring Zoe Loftgren on, U.S. Congresswoman who represents California's 19th congressional district. That's San Jose, Morgan Hill, and Gilroy. And Congresswoman, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm calling from the courtroom off the House floor.
You want to give us a report? And
well, we're in the middle of the debate on the first Good Lad bill, really a terrible bill that would really do nothing to end the family separation. In fact, would memorialize it in statute. Really doesn't do anything to resolve the issue of the Dreamers, which was the original discussion, and eliminates the ability of American citizens to have their family members join them. It's really a terrible bill.
What about those who say the Democrats have to give more, they have to compromise more, and they're not compromising?
Well, you know, first of all, the Republicans have never even had a discussion with us about putting together a compromise bill, and I'm always willing to sit down and talk. I know that you don't get your way 100% of the time. But this is a right-wing dream bill. It's a huge step back from even the status quo, which is very problematic. So this is not any kind of compromise. It would do tremendous damage to the United States.
And you agree, I imagine, with Congresswoman Pelosi, who the minority leader, who is talking about both immigration bills perpetuating child detention?
Oh, absolutely. It actually provides for extended family detention. There is a settlement, I know it's been discussed in the news, but from the late 90s, called the Flores Settlement, that has been amended in the last few years, saying that you can't keep children indefinitely in immigration jail. This would wipe out the Flores Settlement, which you can do through statute. So we would be back to a situation where children alone or children with their parents could be incarcerated in immigration jails, and I've visited them. They are jails. For years.
You've also talked about and expressed a great deal of emotional concern about babies and said that this is a moral low point for the nation. Now President Trump has reversed himself, and your thoughts about that?
One concern I have is we have thousands of children who've been removed from their parents and no apparent plan to reunite them with their parents. In fact, it's not at all clear, and we're making some inquiries now of the administration, that they've even adequately kept track of where they sent these kids. We've heard anecdotes of mothers being shown pictures of their supposed toddler, and it's not their kid. So in addition to, you know, not having long-term incarceration of children and parents, we've got to deal with what the damage that's already been done. These kids, babies, toddlers, toddlers are placed throughout the country. They need to be with their moms and dads.
Let me get a comment from a listener named Rick and have your response, Congresswoman. He writes, isn't it true that Democrats in Congress refuse to allow any immigration bill that gets to the heart of America's problem of sharing a huge border? Sharing a huge border with an economic third world country? Everyone from greedy employers like McDonald's or builders to Democrats looking for dependent voters before it blows up in all of our faces.
Well, I don't really even understand that. We have supported and voted for border security measures repeatedly. I don't think a fourth century solution, a wall, is really what we need for a 21st century problem. But no one in the Democratic caucus who I know of in the House is saying, you know, anybody who wants to come into the country and stay can stay. You have to have borders. You have to have rules that are enforced. But the situation that we have now is a dysfunctional system where families who are divided cannot be united. And one of the things I've learned in my many years is that family ties trump everything else. If you don't come up with a workable system that serves American families and serves our economy, then you're not going to have a workable system you can enforce. As we know, we have farm workers in this country. Most of them are undocumented. There's not a line out the door of Americans asking to go into those fields to pick those strawberries. So if we deport all those farm workers, we're just not going to have any strawberries. We need to have a system that is workable, and then we need to enforce the heck out of it.
You know, there's a new poll that finds that immigration is the number one issue for voters. How do you propose, or how do the Democrats propose we secure our borders?
Well, we have built a lot of fence. We have more than quadrupled the size of the Border Patrol, and there's more on the way. We have massive technology. But I really think in the end, if you don't have a workable system, enforcement alone is not going to work. For example, you have right now people who are fleeing for their lives from Central America. The American law provides for asylum for people who are fleeing from their lives. There should be an orderly process to deal with this situation. The way it's envisioned is that people who have a claim make their claim. It is assessed, and if they win, you know, so be it. They can go on with their lives in the United States. If they lose, they have to leave. Right now, we're not even processing those claims. We're forcing people to go to non-ports of entry to give themselves up to a Border Patrol agent because we're turning them away at the ports of entry. The administration has created a mess at the border. What we need is orderly administration of the law.
All right. Zoe Lofgren, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Zoe Lofgren, U.S. Congresswoman, represents California's 19th Congressional District, San Jose, Morgan Hill, and Gilroy. And let me go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Matthew. Matthew, join us.
Good morning. I'm an independent voter, and I feel that the left and the right are framing this whole situation in a very misleading way, especially the left, who is saying that all these people are showing up at our borders fleeing persecution or violence. But the fact of the matter is we have to verify the stories of each and every single person. And there's going to be administrative mistakes in the process. If you're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of people, we just don't know. We have to verify their story. And if there is some kind of mass exodus going on in Central America, what exactly is happening? Where exactly is it happening? And why isn't the UN getting involved? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Well, those are good questions, and we'll let them stand. Before I go to you on this, Bill Longhain, get a response, though, I wanted to bring in something else that the caller suggested and get you to kind of dovetail these two. And that is, we had Martha Mendoza with us yesterday from the Associated Press, and she said, before we can have any kind of real immigration reform, we're going to have to do, I called it a Marshall Plan, but have to do some kind of help to these countries because there's so much corruption and violence and poverty.
Absolutely. I agree with her 100%, and I'll come back to that. But first to the caller's point, of course, we have to verify everybody's story. And that's what the process is about. And that's what Congresswoman Lofgren was talking about. Everybody has a right to have their case reviewed. And that's what immigration lawyers are involved with. And that's what many people are, unfortunately, who are in detention have to do on their own. It's not about letting in a mass number of people. Everybody has to be evaluated individually. And that's what happens. But yeah, just to dovetail what you just asked and the question that you asked to the congresswoman, who I deeply admire, we spend billions of dollars in enforcement. I'm telling you, there's a virtual wall there already. Okay. And that's why all these folks are being caught. Okay. And the thing is that if we use those resources to meaningfully look at what's happening in Central America, that's your solution. Your solution is to work with these countries to try to minimize what's happening there that's driving the exodus. And you know this, Michael, because I've been on your show for a couple decades now. These are the same issues over and over again. Building that wall is not going to stop people who are coming here in desperation. We've got to be looking at why people are leaving, and that's where our ultimate solution is.
Yeah, I was with a Mexican-American friend yesterday who said to me, well, if they build a wall, there's still a way to go under tunnels, isn't there? Which I thought was certainly provocative and interesting to factor in here. There's also an article that appeared in the BBC, presentation on the BBC. It said that President Trump really has an end game here. He not only wants a wall, he wants border security. He wants to force a deal that would include what would be not only the wall, but end catch and release and end the lottery chain and go to merit-based immigration. I don't know if that's really striking to you, that kind of coherent message that's coming through from this administration, but it seems to make sense.
Oh, I think this is very much about his ultimate goals of reducing immigration from certain parts of the world. And when he says that he wants to end family immigration and the diversity program, for example, who takes advantage of those programs right now? Well, they're mostly people from Latin America and Asian countries, and the diversity visa is primarily benefiting people from African countries who don't have the family relatives to use the family system. And so the end result of eliminating those categories, which he's put on the table, even on the stuff that's being debated today, would be a reduction in immigration from Latin America, Asia, and Africa.
So there is a coherent end game here, you would agree, despite all the pivoting, despite, you know,
I agree. I think that that's what his goal is. And I think that that's what his base very much believes in as well. They continue to have a very Eurocentric, maybe even Western Eurocentric vision of what an American is.
Let me go to more calls and let's go next to Dan. Dan, you're on.
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you for taking my call. I want an absolute clarification on legality of these people coming into the country. It seems to me, according to international law and even our own federal law, if someone comes to our border and presents themselves and asks for asylum, they are not entering the country illegally. They are actually asking for asylum under the current law. Trump administration has referred to these people as being illegally entering the country and therefore having to be arrested and their children taken away. I want to know why they are being categorized as illegal aliens when they are actually seeking asylum. That is my question.
We'll go to you again, Professor Hing.
Yeah, it's all a technicality, okay? He's absolutely right. That if you present yourself at the port of inspection, then you're not attempting to enter illegally. But as your listeners may recall, a month or so ago when this caravan was coming, they didn't want to allow those folks to actually be processed at the port of entry. They were saying that they were at capacity. And it was only after being waiting for whatever it was, 2 or 3, 4 weeks, that they slowly allow those folks to come in. Other folks are being told that we don't have time. We can't take you in. And so their choice then is to go to the non-port of inspection and present themselves there to a Border Patrol officer. In other words, not at the port of inspection. Once they do that, they are accused of attempting to enter without inspection, and that's the misdemeanor. But your caller makes so much sense. If folks are coming here to apply for asylum and not really just trying to sneak across the border,
they have every right to apply for asylum.
Yeah, they should be able to assert their right to apply for asylum. But I'm repeating myself. Attorney General Sessions is trying to reduce the categories under which you can apply for asylum. So that's another way that they're trying to make them into not legitimate asylum seekers.
Question from Tom, and he wants to know, does any country in the world have a workable immigration system?
Well, some would turn to Canada, first of all, they don't put people in custody, okay? And now it's not the same numbers, I understand that, but they are pointed to often, certain European countries. Angela Merkel has tried to be more humane, and of course she's being assaulted from the right as well. This is a huge problem internationally, and I do think that the United States shouldn't be following the path of the Le Pen type folks in Europe and do something better, which is what we've done historically. A friend of mine reminded me that years ago I told him that when it comes to refugees, the United States is actually kind of a model, and I don't think I can say that anymore.
Will asks, one of your guests asserted that the Central American refugees are simply escaping violence. If that's true, why don't they go to another Latin country?
Well, in fact, they have. They've tried to go to other countries. They've tried to go to countries like Panama and Costa Rica, and some have resettled in those parts of the country. Some have tried to apply for asylum in Mexico. Ironically enough, Mexico is not a signatory to the same international conventions that most of the world is. And so Mexico, frankly, is not treating migrants who come through Mexico very well either. And so, but yeah, I do think that there is a responsibility. I agree with the sentiment of that question, that it's not just on the United States. I'm not advocating that. I do think that this is a responsibility that ought to be addressed from a Western Hemisphere type of approach, but we ought to be at the table. We ought to be working with nations in a solution to this problem, rather than trying to isolate ourselves.
The question also prompts me to ask: when we talk about those coming here to flee violence and flee the endemic violence that they're facing in Central America, then there's that National Review article that I alluded to before by Rich Lowry, where he says most of them are coming here mainly for economics. How do you prove you're escaping violence? It's a tough one, isn't it?
Well, it is. And put yourself in a shoe of somebody who's been, the gang is after you or after your family. You're not going to run with and assemble all your evidence before you get here. And listeners ought to understand that the approval rate for asylum is not 90%. The approval rate for asylum nationwide is about 15%. Okay. And that's good. San Francisco is a little bit better than that, but it's not easy to prove your case. And so, yeah, a lot of times people leave for a combination of reasons, but the main reason, we have 250 cases at our immigration clinic at USF. And I would challenge anyone to sit down with a client that we have and that the countless other legal aid programs in the Bay Area have. I would challenge listeners to sit down with a person and think, wow, this person is lying to me and is just coming here to work at Burger King. That's just not so. They've gone through so much trauma. They've gone through god-awful experiences, Michael, back home. But in addition to that, they also had to go through Mexico.
Bill Ong-Hing is our guest. He's professor of law and migration studies, University of San Francisco. Ed raises a kind of interesting point here. He says, can someone please explain why provisions funding the president's proposed border wall are included in legislation? The American people were guaranteed that the Mexican government was going to pay for the wall. What happened to that promise? We don't hear much about it anymore, do we? Bill, are you there? I think we lost Bill Longhing. We'll have to try to get him back on the line here. But the caller certainly, I mean, the emailer certainly raises an interesting point. The president did throughout the campaign. Bill, are you there?
Yeah, I am. I'm sorry. I was on mute. But yeah, I agree with you that he's so focused on having this wall. And of course, Mexico is not going to pay for the wall. But there are sometimes when I wake up saying, given the damn wall, but you know, need the wall. He's got a wall. It's all virtual and it works.
I think we're going to have a problem with your phone line. Well, Jackie Spira said, give him the damn wall, and others in Congress are perhaps going along with that just to, if anything, save the DACA program or get some of these kids out of harm's way. At any rate, we are coming up on another break here, and I just wanted to I'll say goodbye to Bill Longhing, professor of law, again, in migration studies, who has a book that's forthcoming called American Presidents and Immigration Policy. We do have another hour of forum ahead. We're going to talk about cyber warfare with David Sanger in the hour ahead, national security correspondent with The New York Times, who's written a book called The Perfect Weapon, War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. And let me remind you who's behind the scenes here. KQED Forum is produced by Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Christina Kim. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Howard Gelman today. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns had to say goodbye to both of these fine young women, Lisa Botman and Alexandra Wolner. They served us well, and we are grateful for that. Eli Cohen is still with us. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.